If we're gonna fight inflation, it helps to know what's causing it. And that's not as simple as you might think. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Ryssdal. It's Monday, April 4th. Good to have you with us. We're going to start the show with a look ahead to Wednesday, actually. That's when the minutes from the latest meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee come out. Remember, that meeting was when they voted to raise interest rates for the first time in 4 years. And those minutes will give us more insight into how the Fed is thinking about inflation and what to do about it. Last week, we learned the Fed's preferred measure of inflation, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, hit a new 40-year high in February. But how officials, and not just the Fed, should respond depends a lot on what's causing inflation. And that's a question reporter Emily Stewart at Vox set out to answer in her latest story. Emily, good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You would think it would be fairly straightforward what's causing the inflation we're seeing, and a lot of economists, you know, claim to know. But as it turns out, it's not that simple. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, when I set out to do this story, you know, my editor said, well, just, you know, ask what's causing inflation and what's going to fix it. And everybody that I told this to kind of laughed at me because there are a lot of things, there are a lot of things going on. And with some, you know, there's some consensus. And when some, there's really not. I mean, anybody goes to Twitter to look at economists and they spend a lot of the day arguing with each other about what's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And so let's talk about some of the factors. I actually made a list of them because it's frankly hard to keep track. We know obviously the pandemic and the supply chain issues that caused are a big part of this. But you talk about some deeper roots to this inflation, say investment in infrastructure, for example.
Right. You know, some of the people I spoke to said, listen, a lot of this is sort of the chickens coming home to roost over the years. We know that our supply chains for years have been kind of underinvested in. We have a lot of last minute supply chains, of just in time supply chains where everything's basically, if there's one tiny little thing out of whack, it's going to throw the whole system out of whack. And what we've seen over the past couple of years is that a lot of things can be thrown out of whack pretty quickly, and suddenly the fact that the country hasn't invested in infrastructure, that companies haven't made investments in infrastructure to make things work better, that really does eventually have a cost.
One of the big debates is, and it really, I think, sometimes boils down to sort of someone's political position, is whether this is all about the federal stimulus coming out of the pandemic that overheated the recovery, or if this is companies basically greed. They're, you know, they are charging more because they can. What do you think is behind that divide, and how much do we know about whether each of these factors is playing a role here, or how much?
As you said, a lot of this is politics. There are plenty of people who say the American Rescue Plan that President Biden signed into law when he first came into office did it. That the real problem here is the stimulus checks. And there are plenty of people that say, listen, like, it's hard to make that one-to-one comparison. If you see where inflation is happening, that's not exactly it. And plenty of people also, especially Democrats and some progressives, are arguing that it is corporate concentration, that it's corporate greed, that companies are taking a look at the inflation narrative and saying, hey, we can kind of bump up our margins a little bit more. I think what's tricky there is that, like, are some companies probably doing that? Sure. Is that causing inflation? Hard to say. Corporate concentration wasn't invented over the past 2 years.
Well, you know, part of me is wondering, does it matter that there are a lot of causes and we don't necessarily know what's playing the biggest role? The answer is that we need a lot of different tacks to try to solve this. And I wonder what you think about that. Do we need consensus?
I mean, to a certain extent, we don't need consensus. At the same time, if you don't really know what the problem is, it does make it a little bit difficult to fix. Not to say that there aren't plenty of people trying. We've seen the Federal Reserve saying that they're starting to raise interest rates, so they're going to try and take the actions that they can take, but that's going to take some time to shake out. You know, the White House is trying to kind of help out supply chains and improve trucking, but there's only so much that they can do. And, you know, one person said to me, one of the best things the White House can do is to be honest with people that this is going to take some time. At the same time, certain factors causing inflation right now, like Russia's war in Ukraine, like COVID in China, is just completely out of American policymakers' control.
What do you think the long-term implications of not getting this right could be? You know, why is it so important that we understand?
Well, I think as much as we like to say the current moment is unprecedented, it is and it isn't, right? If these are problems that we don't understand now and we don't fix now, then this could happen again. And, you know, I talked to one economist who said, if you do believe that it was fiscal stimulus that did too much, in the future, that might make a Congress that is less willing to do fiscal stimulus in another downturn. And so it is important to try and figure this stuff out.
Because even if there's not a next time, there will be a next time that rhymes, at least with what we're going through.
Exactly.
Emily Stewart is a writer at Vox. Thanks for walking through this with us. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
On Wall Street today, green light go. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We just heard from Emily Stewart that trucking is one industry the Biden administration is targeting to grease the supply chain wheels. Earlier today, the president gave an update on his trucking action plan. For starters, he wants more truckers. The White House is pushing a pilot program that would allow people as young as 18 to drive big rigs. It's also trying to recruit more women into the industry. And the president wants to cut down on something called detention. No, no one's in trouble. That's the time truckers spend just waiting at ports and warehouses to load their vehicles with freight. Marketplace's Matt Levin reports.
Ideally, truckers get in and out of a warehouse or distribution center within a couple hours. But even before COVID, detention often took much longer. Back when he was a long hauler in the 1970s, Todd Spencer came prepared.
I read books by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I read Les Mis.
An O. Henry short story wasn't going to cut it. Spencer is now the president of the Owner-Operator Independent Drivers Association. He says a large contributor to trucker burnout is just this waiting time, time that has gotten longer after COVID and time that truckers often don't get paid for.
It's a monumental problem in terms of driver satisfaction, but in the bigger picture, it undermines the efficiency of our entire supply chain.
David Carell at MIT agrees. According to his research, truck drivers on average spend only 6.5 hours actually driving, well below the 11 hours they're legally allowed. He says a driver shortage may be kind of a misdiagnosis.
We could carry all the loads that we needed to carry with the drivers that we have if we just made better use of their time. And we do that by reducing how long it takes to load and unload.
The trucking industry acknowledges detention is a problem. They don't want their trucks stuck at a warehouse for days on end. Many fleets charge extra for slow shippers. But Bob Costello with the American Trucking Associations maintains the driver shortage is real. And even if detention times were cut,
the driver shortage, it's so broad that none of these things on their own will fix it.
But it would help if there wasn't a shortage of warehouse workers, too. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Ukrainian leaders are calling for more sanctions from Western governments against Russia after the discovery of mass graves near Kyiv. The Biden administration says it will announce more sanctions this week. Last week, it said it would extend sanctions to entities and individuals connected to the Russian tech sector. And that is on top of blocking Russia from the SWIFT interbank messaging system, freezing the assets of Russia's central bank, and a long list of other sanctions on Russian banks and businesses. One reason the U.S. can do all this is the power of the dollar. It's the most widely used currency internationally, and the U.S. financial system touches just about every corner of the globe. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, these actions could have unintended consequences.
The U.S. dollar can be found far beyond U.S. borders.
A great deal of trade is denominated in dollars. It's, so you're quoting the price of a barrel of oil, even between China and Venezuela, they quote in dollars.
Ken Rogoff is professor of economics at Harvard.
The footprint of the dollar is roughly three times the size of our economy. If you look at the U.S. share, say, of trade or world GDP.
And a lot of the world's financial deal-making at least touches the U.S. financial system, which gives the U.S. leverage.
The U.S. controls a lot of the inner workings of the global financial system.
Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the U.S. has pushed the levers of its financial power to nearly full tilt, even going so far as to freeze the reserves that Russia's central bank held around the world.
That's really, you know, the nuclear option in this game.
That, Rogoff says, was a shock, not just to Russia, but to China as well.
And the Chinese, they're not saying anything. They're going to move very quietly. But I can assure you that behind the scenes, they're talking about how they can move faster than they were planning.
Move faster to establishing Chinese currency, traditional or digital, as a global leader, particularly in Asia. And move faster to fortify its own payment system. Russia's internal payment system, for example, protected its domestic credit card industry from U.S.-led sanctions. It's reportedly seeking to export that system to Venezuela and Iran. Scott Kennedy is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The more we use sanctions, the less the dollar and our banking system are viewed as benign to everyone, and it creates pressures for others to find workarounds.
Take, for example, global payment systems. Aaron Klein is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Payments are a network economy subject to tipping points. That is, payment systems work and people don't want to start new ones. It's very difficult. But at some point, that could reach a tipping point where there's enough incentive for other countries to figure out an alternative.
So then, is the world reaching a tipping point or anywhere close to it?
No. America and its allies across the world have cut Russia out of the payment system because Russia did something way out of bounds.
If you aren't planning on invading a sovereign nation, then you don't need to worry, says Klein.
That's very different than using the payment system because you don't like the regime in charge, something the United States has done to other countries in the past, see Cuba.
Still, it's easy to imagine such steps would be on the table were China to invade Taiwan, for example. And it would make sense that China would want to insulate itself. Its size and economic power suggest the renminbi or its developing digital currency might take a globally important role. But Scott Kennedy at CSIS says that's not happening.
For all of China's talk about wanting to be independent and self-sufficient in with technology and finance, there is no off-ramp to the global economy.
China will continue, he says, to be deeply dependent on and interconnected with the world economy. And its currency isn't close to being a global competitor, nor is any other at this point, not the euro, not the yen, both of which, over the years, have stirred fears they may replace the dollar.
No one should be scared at this moment that there is a competitor to the dollar or to SWIFT that should make the U.S. worried that its hegemony is going to disappear anytime in the very near future.
In the very near future. But the world is already a different place than it was just 3 years ago. So 10, 20, 30 years from now, who knows? In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the snow was so contaminated.
Yuck. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 103 points, 0.3%, to close at 34,921. The NASDAQ rose 271 points, 1.9%, to end at 14,532. And the S&P 500 grew 36 points, 0.8%, to finish at 4582. Twitter soared more than 27% after Tesla boss Elon Musk bought a 9.2% passive stake in the social media firm. Facebook's parent company Meta climbed 4%. Google parent Alphabet found 2%. Almost half the people who own cryptocurrency in the U.S., Asia, and Latin America bought it for the first time last year, according to a new survey from the U.S. cryptocurrency exchange Gemini. The survey of almost 30,000 people was conducted in 20 countries between November of last year and February 2022. Some cited inflation as a reason for adopting crypto. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.39%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. On his first day back as interim CEO of Starbucks, Howard Schultz made some news. He's suspending the company's stock buyback program to free up cash to invest in the coffee chain's workforce. Starbucks is facing a big union push. The decision is counter to a trend we've been seeing for a while now of companies repurchasing their own shares. Just last week, transportation company Norfolk Southern and athleisure maker Lululemon both announced big stock buybacks. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has this explainer.
When a company has some extra cash on hand, it has a few options. It can sit on it. It can invest it back into the business, it can pay it out to shareholders through dividends, or it can do the same thing by repurchasing its own shares.
In which a firm goes out to the open market and buys back its own shares of stock and retires them.
Alice Boname is a professor of finance at the University of Arizona. She says stock buybacks lower a company's total share count and boost per-share profits. They also send a message.
You often hear firms saying things like, we believe our stock is the best investment out there. And so definitely they're trying to build confidence with shareholders.
In the early days of the pandemic, companies were trying to conserve cash. But in the last 18 months or so, buybacks have made a comeback, says analyst Howard Silverblatt with S&P Dow Jones Indices.
Where we stand now is that companies are spending more money and setting records.
In the fourth quarter of 2021, S&P companies spent $270 billion in buybacks. Silverblatt says part of this buyback binge is companies trying to get their shares back now that profits are rolling in and they can afford to.
But also, they need to spend more because share prices are up significantly.
The market is just more expensive now. And all that money companies are spending purchasing their own shares, that's money they're not investing back into the business, says William Lozonik. He's an economist at UMass Lowell and a critic of stock buybacks.
It comes at the expense of workers' wages. It comes at the expense of companies investing in their future generation of products.
He says too much focus on propping up stock prices can detract from a company's long-term success. Another vocal critic of stock buybacks is President Biden. He recently proposed new restrictions, saying buybacks reward executives but get in the way of innovation and company growth. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Here's an acronym you'll probably hear a lot more in the near future, PFAS. The so-called forever chemicals are used in products like nonstick pans and waterproof jackets and are suspected of causing cancer and other health problems. Several states have banned their use in things like food packaging, cosmetics, and firefighting equipment. and many more are considering legislation this year. The Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck reports now on an effort to ban one particular kind of PFAS product, ski wax.
I'm up at Bogus Basin, a ski resort outside Boise, Idaho. A warm day means slightly slushy snow, but folks are trickling onto the ski lift all the same. In the rental building, manager Eric Strubar buffs the wax on a child's ski. Strubar says he heard about PFAS being a problem in high-end ski waxes a few years ago. The chemicals had been on skis and boards in various forms for decades already.
There were myriad of powders and different things, and then waxes that were mixed, you know, had them mixed into it.
Now there are a number of races where the substance is actually banned. That came after concerns about people manufacturing and regularly using the waxes, as well as worries about the environment. But Srubar says as long as the playing field is even, that's what matters to competitors most.
I haven't heard any complaints.
PFAS wax, also called fluoro or fluorinated wax, does make skiers go faster than older alternatives, especially in cross-country races. But research shows the wax can contaminate the snow and ground. Gail Carlson is an assistant professor at Colby College in Maine. Her son was a Nordic racer, and she was concerned about the waxes. So after a race in 2020, she went to the start line and tested the snow.
And the snow was so contaminated that the testing lab that did our work for us, you know, asked me, like, what is this sample?
As I mentioned earlier, it's now against the rules to use PFAS wax in certain races. But racing organizations have been taking a measured approach that makes things a bit confusing now. Rules depend on the types of PFAS, whether a race is in the U.S., who's running the race, and what event it is.
Cross country has gone all in on a fluoro-free environment.
That's Stephen Poulin, managing director of Brav USA. Brav owns ski wax leaders Swix and Toco. Poulin says that while rules are complicated now, the future of wax is PFAS-free. His company no longer makes PFAS waxes, thanks to millions spent on a research project it started in 2009.
We knew there was different chemistry out there that was just better for the environment.
The EPA did fine Swix in 2020 after its PFAS wax imports violated the Toxic Substances Control Act. Still, Poulin says that the outcome of EPA's sanction was a good one, including a $1 million public education campaign about PFAS wax.
I think we're going to all be able to look back and go, wow, that's how it's supposed to work. That's really how it's supposed to work.
If PFAS waxes are banned worldwide, there are scanners of a sort to detect it in the field, but they don't work perfectly yet, and not everybody has one. Still, bans alone could work. Maine ordered industries to phase out all kinds of unnecessary PFAS uses by 2030, including ski wax. That's thanks to research like Carlson's in Maine, and the ski area that she tested a few years ago is also banning PFAS wax. So she went back to see how the ban was working.
Another research student and I went out and gathered snow again at the start line right after the race, and there was hundreds of times less PFAS contamination in the snow.
Ultimately, those in the ski wax industry say their successes show that other kinds of industries can make the move away from PFAS too. But that will likely take millions of dollars in research and more efforts to find effective alternatives. In Boise, Idaho, I'm Madeline Beck for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. Look, no one wants to go out on a downer, but we need to talk about this. In a new report, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says it's now or never. Without immediate and deep reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, it will be impossible to limit global warming to just 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels and avoid the most catastrophic consequences of climate change. We're now at 1.1 degree higher. There is some hope in this report, though. It's the latest of a series from the IPCC, this one focused on mitigation, and it's packed with solutions, including a faster transition to solar and wind energy, plugging methane leaks from mines and landfills, and constructing and retrofitting buildings to be more efficient. The report basically says the tools are there. We just need the will. All right, here's your moment of economic context on this Monday. The Commerce Department said today orders at U.S. factories fell in February, something analysts expected as supply shortages continue and consumers shift more of their spending from goods to services. After a huge drop at the start of the pandemic, this was the first decline in 10 months. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, John McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.